Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. This is episode 19 of what was going to be a 20-part podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. I did warn that it would probably go to be more like 20 or 25 episodes because, well, as history goes on, there ends up being more history. What I mean to say is that as we get to the 16th century, 500 years ago, suddenly the Catholic Church expands, it becomes global rather than just European, but also it becomes entangled, therefore, much more in, again, in the politics of the time and on the cultural changes, the philosophies of the time which are coming up. And all of these things need to be dealt with if we're going to understand where we are today, now at the beginning of the 21st century. And so today's episode, episode 19, is going to be covering the 17th century, from 1600 to 1700. However, in order to understand the 17th century, we have to, again, go back into the century before, into the 16th century. Again, we've already spent two episodes on the 16th century, this hugely revolutionary century, not only in the Catholic Church, but in world history. Just to summarize, in the 1500s, we saw the great figures of Michelangelo and Shakespeare and Thomas More, St. Thomas More, Erasmus, Martin Luther, John Calvin, the great reformers and the great counter-reformation figures. All of this is happening in this comparatively short time period of the 16th century and the 1500s. So we have to spend a little bit more time looking again in more detail at what happened in the 16th century so that we can move on and look at how that played out into the 17th century, because that's then going to set the stage for the 18th, 19th, and 20th century, these tumultuous 500 years. What we basically see in the 16th century, in the 1500s, is Europe moving out of the Middle Ages into the modern age, and this huge transition which takes place in the 16th century is revolutionary, and revolution means turning around. Things are turned upside down. The old medieval system is done, is finished, which had been there for 1,000 years. Basically, think of Saint Benedict from the 6th century, right, and then to the Martin Luther in the 16th century. For that 1,000 years, we can call that the Middle Ages. And that's the time of Christendom, the monasteries, and all the great accomplishments of the Catholic faith. But this is changing. This revolution takes over. And what we will see now is that in the 17th century, in the 1600s, we really do begin to see the foundation for modern Catholicism. Catholicism as we understand it, and also Catholicism which we think of as being traditional or being the Catholicism of the ages. In fact, what we consider to be traditional Catholicism, or even traditionalist Catholicism, is really the Catholicism of the Counter-Reformation. And we're going to see how some of these major figures and major events, which are in the 16th century, the second half of the 16th century, the rest of the 1500s, moving right up through into the 17th century, the 1600s, which we'll look at in this episode, and how this really lays the foundation for Catholicism as we know it today. So in order to do that, we really need to go back again into the roots of the Counter-Reformation. I dealt with the Counter-Reformation and the Council of Trent very briefly in the last episode, but we really need to spend more time, because the Counter-Reformation is God's answer to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. And the Counter-Reformation, of course, has as one of its pivot points the Council of Trent. Trent is a city in northern Italy where it was chosen in 1545 by Paul III to finally, probably around 25 or 30 years late, to finally call a reforming council of the church. When it first met in 1545, there were only 30 bishops there, and the council would extend for 18 years, ending in 1563. But in saying it extended for 18 years, for 10 years between 1551 and 1561, it actually didn't meet, and the council, for some reasons I'll explain, was suspended for those 10 years. But first, we really need to look at the roots of the council. And the roots of it, as all the great reform movements in the church, really begin with one passionate individual. There have been various different reform movements in the early part of the 1500s at the local level and at local diocesan level, but it was the Bishop of Verona, John Matteo Ghiberti, who was a member of the Oratory of Divine Love, who began really reforming his own bishop and doing this reformation work both in pastoral practice and in theology, but also in the administration of his diocese with new legislation and so forth, which really set a kind of hallmark or a template for the reforms which were going to come at the Council of Trent. Remember, during the time of the Avignon Papacy and the Great Schism, and the time when there were two and even three rival claimants to the papacy, it was the Council of Constance which resolved that problem. And so conciliarism was still a trend in the church, but the popes and the cardinals were resisting it because, of course, if a council had power over a pope, then the pope and the cardinals would be losing their influence, and they saw that as a dangerous trend. Not only because they lost their own power, but also because the power of apostolic authority and apostolic succession would be handed over to a kind of democratic process, which they saw as being dangerous. So conciliarism, the idea of having a council which could reform the church, was resisted, even in the face of the onslaught of the Protestant Reformation. But it was the renewal efforts and the reform efforts of this Bishop of Verona which began to inspire the Council of Trent. And so, as I said, in 1545, Pope Paul III finally called the Council of Trent. And this is unusual because Paul III was a pope who was a lover of all the great things in life. He laid on big festivals in Rome, and he had an opulent life himself, and he enjoyed parties, and he enjoyed the high life, but he also understood the need to reform the church. And so there's this paradoxical figure of Paul III who actually does bring about the Council of Trent. And the Council of Trent is going to, as I say, go for 18 years. But during the 10-year break in between 1551 and 1561, the Emperor Charles V tried to reunite Protestants and Catholics. He was unsuccessful in that, but that effort stalled the Council of Trent. And then Paul III's successor, Paul IV, was a very strong-minded pope. He was a diligent, even tyrannical reformer, and he preferred to take papal action to further the cause of reform, and didn't have much time for a council. So he suspended the council, and it was Pope Pius IV who recalled the council in 1561 to continue its work. So the council was dealing with various different issues, and one of them was they wrestled head-on with the doctrinal confusion that had been brought about by the Protestant Reformation. And it was a very conservative council. The bishops stepped up to the plate, and they denied the Calvinist doctrine of total depravity, and they said that man was created good, but he also needed hope and charitable works, which were empowered by God's grace. They reasserted the Catholic teaching and clarified the Catholic teaching on the seven sacraments, the hierarchical nature of the church, the divine institution of the priesthood, and also the traditional medieval teaching on transubstantiation and the sacrificial character of the Mass. The Council of Trent, the Fathers of Trent stepped up and reaffirmed these points very clearly in the face of the Protestant onslaught. They also reasserted, therefore, papal supremacy. They remember that the doctrine of papal infallibility is going to come later as a formal doctrine, but certainly the Council of Trent ironically stepped on the whole notion of conciliarism by supporting and reinforcing the authority of the Pope over the whole Church. And so in doing this, you can see that what they were able to do was to really affect a new uniformity and a new allegiance to the Pope as the head of the spiritual head of the church. And this was going to actually, this served a great purpose as the church began to expand through missionary efforts. Remember, during this crucial 16th century, the 1500s, is when the New World is being explored. It was 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So at the end of the 15th century is when Columbus discovers America, and America, the Americas are being settled, but also missionary efforts going out to India and to China and to the Philippines. All of this is going on at the same time, and therefore the Council of Trent, which solidifies Catholic doctrine, clarifies Catholic doctrine, also clarifies the authority of the Pope, allows the missionary effort to go on with a unified and a coherent doctrine, unified and coherent system of church administration. So the Council of Trent's importance can't be overemphasized for this new age that we're moving into, where the church is going to become global as these new areas of the world are explored, not just the Americas, but also reaching out into Asia and taking the Catholic faith. It was a reformed Catholic faith, a Catholic faith which was suddenly equipped to do this missionary work. And one of the other things which helped all of this was actually the reform of the Mass, which took place as part of the second of the Council of Trent. The commission that Trent sent up to reform the Mass did the work rather quickly, and in 1570 it issued the new Missal. And the Missal had gone through and tidied up the medieval Mass. And for people who say, you know, the Tridentine Mass, the traditionalist Mass, the Latin Mass, is the Mass of the ages, well, yes and no. The thing is, by the Middle Ages, various accretions had come into the Mass, and there was diversity in the different rites that were used in England and in Spain and in Italy and around Europe. Different religious orders and different dioceses used different rites of the Mass, and different superstitions and unusual devotions had crept in some places. And the Fathers of Trent went through and pared all that down and presented to the Church a unified liturgy. So along with the unified and the clarified doctrine went this new, newly formed and newly edited form of the Mass, which would therefore become the Mass, which would be used universally in the Church until the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. So we can see the value of this Tridentine Mass, the value of the Mass of Trent, as being this great unifying force in the Church, this uniform liturgy of the Mass, which could then be exported and used in Latin in all the different cultures that the Church went to, in Central America, South America, in its missionary efforts to North America and Canada, in its missionary efforts to China and India, the Philippines, across the world, this one Mass would be able to unify Catholics and provide a uniform religious expression no matter where it was. Of course, one of the problems with this is that it began to be understood that this uniform Mass of Trent would therefore become a form of Mass which could never be changed. And traditionalists, therefore, who are against the Second Vatican Council, will say that, yes, the Second Vatican Council should never have changed this Mass, which was timeless. In fact, the Mass of Trent was itself a reform of various different forms of the Mass and rites that had developed through the Middle Ages. So the Church does have the authority to change and to modify the liturgy, this will continue to be a cause for debate. So one of the downsides of the Mass of Trent is that it became ossified, if you like, as the only form of the Mass that could ever be celebrated from time immemorial. And this is one of the big debates, of course, between traditionalists and those who accept the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, which we'll, of course, deal with later. Well, some of the other reform popes during this time period, one of the most famous, of course, was Pius V. We dealt with him in the last episode, and he was a very monastic and ascetical person who transformed the Vatican from this place of patron of the arts and the high life and the wealthy life of the popes, and really brought in a great spiritual heart to it all. Some people say he turned the Vatican into a monastery. Some of the other reforming popes during the second half of the 16th century then are Gregory the 13th, and he's working with Charles Borromeo. Although Gregory the 13th reverted to being a fairly worldly man in his own life, he did continue the work of the reform. Sixtus the 5th was another stern and austere pope. He was very keen on the Spanish on the Inquisition, and the Inquisition during this time did help to eradicate heresy, but of course it was strict, and it was harsh in many cases as well. We can't go on without referring again back to the Jesuits, who again in the 16th century began their work of spreading the gospel and their great missionary efforts. So these efforts, which again were going on in the 16th century, are laying the foundation for the reform which is going to come in the 17th century. Again, I would like to also remind you about St. Charles Borromeo, of Milan, who in the second half of the 16th century also helped to bring these reforms into place. Moving forward now, after the Council of Trent, we see the shift in the church to becoming one which also echoes what was happening with the Protestant Reformation. Suddenly, the faith is turning towards more of a personal relationship with God, and so new devotions are growing up. A Eucharistic piety becomes much stronger, so that devout Catholics begin receiving communion once a week. And priests and bishops are even celebrating Mass daily. Eucharistic piety was extended to include the adoration of the host in services like benediction and the 40 hours. Some of these things which we take so much for granted as being part of timeless Catholicism, like Eucharistic adoration and daily Mass and these personal devotions, these are actually the product of the Counter-Reformation, and they were not part of a great part of medieval Catholicism. And so when we see the history of the church, we see that actually these devotions and these different liturgical expressions do actually change and grow as time moves on. The Tridentine spirituality was very sacramental, focused on the Eucharist. It was also making very strong demands on individual Christians, self-discipline and self-control, regularity in prayer, and it was again, emphasizing the personal dimension of faith. It's no surprise then that there were various different, vigorous and committed and wonderful saints that come out of the same time period as well. In 1595 is the death of St. Philip Neri, the founder of the Oratory, a man who combined a whimsical cheerfulness and a zest for life with a deep interior spirituality. He inspired many people, to including popes and priests, with his heartfelt spirituality and love for the Lord. Of course, at the end of the 16th century, we also have the deaths of Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross, both dying towards the end of the 1500s, and then moving on into the new century and into the 17th century. St. Francis de Sales converted an awful lot of Protestants back to the faith with his writings and with his gentle spirit. Along with him was St. Jane de Chantal, one of his mentees, who actually founded the religious order of the Visitation Sisters. St. Vincent de Paul, who died in 1660, working with the poor. St. Louise de Mauriac, who founded the Sisters of Charity in 1633. All of this work with the poor and with personal devotion is growing during the 17th century. During this time, there was also renewal in the universities, in Salamanca, in Rome, Paris, Louvain. They were returning again to the work of Thomas Aquinas and refreshing that aspect of Catholic theology. St. Robert Bellarmine, who died in 1621, was another influential figure of the Counter-Reformation. Francis Suarez, also another intellectual and a theologian. We can't forget, of course, the great missionary efforts that the St. Francis Xavier going out to India and in China and to Japan, a heroic figure who made many, many converts. Also, the Jesuit Matteo Ricci, who reached out to China during this time period. We also have the Jesuit martyrs of North America. St. John de Brebeuf and his companions, as well as the great Jesuits and Franciscans who came to Central America, South America, and to the New World. All of this is done in a most energetic and wonderful way, so that really by the end of the Council of Trent in 1563, Protestantism had established its work across, its foothold across Europe, by the end of the Counter-Reformation, Poland had turned back to Catholicism. Large parts of Germany, France, and the southern Netherlands were restored to communion with Rome. And overseas, the Catholic gains in the missions overshadowed the losses that had happened during the Protestant Reformation. I can't get into too many of the political controversies that were happening at this time, but we have to mention the religious wars that took place, the 30 Years' War between 1618 and 1648. This was the breakdown of a fragile peace, the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, and the increase of Catholic power began to cause the 30 Years' War. Basically, the wars of religion during this time period were that the different European powers were taking sides between Protestant and Catholic. And of course, they used their religion as a means and a motivating force for their warfare. But we can't neglect the fact that the European powers were also jockeying for political and economic and financial power over Europe. And the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation has to be seen as part of these greater political and military struggles. But the Church after the Council of Trent did actually bring about a fantastic change. And the change that we see is basically the Church shifting gears by the power of the Holy Spirit from the medieval age into the modern age. The Pope was again in complete command of the Church, and on every front, spiritual, intellectual, cultural, and missionary, there were great victories. And the spiritual sort of strength and confidence of this Trinitarian Church was captured, therefore, in the architecture you still see when you go to Rome. So when you go to the Church of the Gesù, for instance, the Jesuit Church in Rome, you see this fantastic Baroque structure with the most triumphant sort of decoration and art or in the interior. Also, the artists Bernini and Borromini, under the popes, they began even more building all around Rome. Some of the things which are most famous and hallmarks and sort of signatures of the Church today, which we take for granted, were created during the 17th century by the great sculptor and architect Bernini. So the baldacchino, the canopy, for instance, over the high altar in St. Peter's, with its curlicue pillars and its fantastic bronze canopy, that was designed by Bernini. The arched, the curved colonnade, which you see, which encircles St. Peter's Square and gives like a sort of welcoming embrace as you come up to the entrance of St. Peter's, that colonnade is designed by Bernini. When you go into the Piazza Navona in Rome and you see the famous marble fountain of the four rivers, which dominates the center of the square, that's a production of Bernini. And when you go to the far end of St. Peter's and you see the great shrine of the chair of Peter, surrounded by the four fathers of the Church, fantastic sculptures in this window with the Holy Spirit light pouring through the alabaster window of the Holy Spirit dove, all of that is produced by Bernini. And all of that Baroque splendor of the Church in Rome And when you go around the churches of Rome, you'll see so many of them had the Baroque splendor added to them. When I say Baroque splendor, I mean pillars and porticos and frescoes and fantastic, overly exuberant frescoes and paintings in the ceilings of cherubs and heaven and saints, and all of this Baroque architecture, this Baroque artwork, this Baroque sculpture is showing the exuberance, the confidence, the great renewal of the church in the Counter-Reformation. And this is right through the 17th century, therefore. These are the great hallmarks of this particular century. And it's a time for, I guess, if this is called Triumphs and Tragedies, this is part of the triumph of the church in the Counter-Reformation. However, this particular time period is not without its troubles. Part of this same enthusiasm and new devotion in the church also produces in France a heresy which is called Jansenism. And Cornelius Jansen was a bishop who wrote a book about Saint Augustine, and he stressed certain aspects of Augustine's teaching, which were great emphasis on original sin and on human sinfulness, and the reliance, therefore, the Christians could not actually do anything on their own to please God. And Jansenism, therefore, began to take a real domination in the church of the 17th century in France, and Jansen's views were taken up especially in a convent of Port Royal, and the convent became a center, therefore, for Jansenism, and the nuns were known the convent was known for its studious atmosphere, and the number of novices it attracted. It was a kind of conservative and very devout center of French Catholicism. It's known, of course, for converting the brilliant mathematician and inventor Blaise Pascal, and he, during this 17th century, was one of their main defenders. Now, however, the other strong and dominant force at this time period, of course, is the Jesuits. And the Jesuits stood for a much more liberal kind of spirituality. They did not agree that man was totally depraved. Instead, they understood and wanted to promote the idea that human wisdom and human reason could discover God, and that man was, they were more optimistic about human nature. They, therefore, came to clash with the Jansenists. The Jansenists and the Jesuits were clashing. And both of these views had important implications for morality. Because of their optimistic view of human nature, the Jesuits stood for morality that in many ways resembled another philosophical trend which was going on at the same time, especially in France, and that is the Enlightenment, which we will talk about later as it especially comes into full flower in the 18th century. But in the 17th century, the roots of the root causes of the Enlightenment were already beginning with Descartes and some of the other thinkers, in which they were on the one hand very cynical and skeptical about things and very doubtful, but also much more optimistic about human nature. And at the same time, there were new discoveries in science. This was the time of Galileo and the discoveries about astronomy. So there was this ferment also within society, within rationalism and within the humanism, in which there was more and more of an optimism about human nature. And meanwhile, these conservative Catholics, the Jansenists, were being very negative about human nature and saying, no, we're all sinners. We need to have a devout life of prayer and self-discipline and a strict life, which is pessimistic about human nature. Meanwhile, the Jesuits are saying, "Well, no, mankind is not that bad, and we can find God through our own power and through our own reason." Well, Pascal and the Jansenists were able to therefore put the Jesuits in a bad light, because they portrayed the Jesuits as being lax about being too easygoing about human nature, about actually overlooking and encouraging sin, and even allowing sinful people to come into the church and saying, you know, God loves everybody, and human nature is not so bad, and if we all have a good will towards God, we'll get there in the end. You see the kind of clash which was there between the Jansenists and the Jesuits. Well, this blew up into a definite theological debate, in which the Pope eventually took the side of the Jesuits and declared the teachings of Jansen to be a heresy. The Jansenists returned with a little bit of... if you like, Jesuitical thinking, in which they said, well, yes, we agree with the Pope that the teachings of Jansen are formally heresy, but we don't really believe that. What we believe is actually something a little bit different, and so they refused to actually comply, and the Jansenists continued with their efforts, making some great gains, and the Jesuits actually having some discipline against them, and it went back and forth during this 17th century between these two methods, of these two ways of thought within the church. And while we see that this is happening in France, in fact, it was happening. They were influential also around the rest of the church. And this is what we're going to see is a problem that continues right on into the 18th century. There was an uneasy peace during which the Jansenists, led by their leader Arnauld, fortified their position, and Pope Innocent XI, who died in 1689, seemed to lean in their direction as well, and sort of went against the Jesuits, who were leading, who were prevailing at that time. Well, there was another problem that also came up in the church during the 17th century. And this is called Gallicanism. Now, Gallicanism, again, grew up in France, and this is extending into the 18th century as well. So we're sort of straddling two different centuries here, but Gallicism was basically a clash between the secular ruler and the church. It grew up with the great King Henry, King Louis XIV. And Louis XIV was trying to assert his power with by reaffirming a traditional power that the kings had of taking some of the church revenue and making some of the church appointments. And he drew up, and the Pope, Innocent XI, who was very austere and scholarly and otherworldly, wasn't going to be intimidated by Louis XIV, the famous Sun King, the king of Versailles. And so he actually stood up to the king, and the king, not used to being stood up to at all, gathered his clergy together and issued what was called the Four Articles. He acknowledged the spiritual primacy of the popes as the successor of Peter, but he denied their authority over temporal affairs. He went back to the Council of Constance and claimed the superiority of a general council over a pope, which Trent had thought they had done away with, and he insisted on standing up to the Pope and asserting his own power. Well, a veritable war broke out between France and the papacy, which occupied a good part of the 17th century. At the death of Innocent in 1689, both sides kind of compromised, and they were able to resolve the problem. But it didn't resolve the problem forever, because the nation-states around Europe were continuing to grow in power, and we're going to see that right through to the 18th century there are struggles between the papacy and the secular powers, and that these struggles, the papacy, we will see, continues to actually to lose, because the revenues and the power of the popes continue to decline right through the 17th century and the 18th century. I want to continue here with just a little bit of a summary about the different popes that are occupying the throne of Peter during this Counter-Reformation period. We see that Pope Urban VIII is one of the great dominating popes during this 17th century. He's pope between 1623 and 1644. He's the patron of Bernini that I spoke about, and patron of some of the great artworks that we see all around Rome. And Innocent the 10th follows him, Alexander the 12th, and then there are two Clements, Clement the 9th, Clement the 10th, who are popes just during the 1660s and 1670s. And then Pope Innocent the 11th, who I just referred to, who was standing up to the French king, Louis the 14th. Alexander the 13th and Innocent the 12th bring us to the end of the 17th century. Popes who are continuing to push the reform of the church and also clashing with getting involved in the clash between Jansenism and the Jesuits, and also clashing in political sphere with the King of France. Also, in the political military sphere, we have to mention during the religious wars, 1620 is the Battle of White Mountain outside of Prague, and this is where the Catholic victory in the Thirty Years' War is suddenly won, and the Infant of Prague, the famous Infant of Prague, is erected in a church in Prague, which was reclaimed from the Lutherans, and Our Lady of Victories, the Feast of Our Lady of Victories, is proclaimed and upheld again, reaffirmed after it was first proclaimed in 1571 by Pope Pius V after the Battle of Lepanto. So with a number of battles that are won in the military and political sphere, by the 1620s we see a kind of triumphant Counter-Reformation Church. In 1622, this is kind of symbolically sealed with the canonizations of Teresa of Avila, Ignatius Loyola, Philip Neri, and Francis Xavier, four of the great saints of the Counter-Reformation era. Now, as usual, I want to spend just a moment trying to apply what we learned from the 17th century and the Counter-Reformation to the situation in the church today. Well, it applies in a couple of different ways. First of all, it illuminates the clash between traditionalist Catholics and Vatican II Catholics, as if we can call them that. Traditionalist Catholics would like to believe that the Council of Trent and the Tridentine Mass is the Mass of the ages and the historic Catholic faith. Well, it is, but it's 500 years old, but it's not actually in a sense, older than that. Of course, it built on what had gone before in the first 1500 years of the church, and it wasn't a break from that, but there were so many innovations and so many new things that came in the Council of Trent, good things which happened, the mission that I've been talking about, the missionary efforts, the great saints, the renewal of the church, the reform of the church, the reform of the papacy, all of these things were a new surge of the Holy Spirit in the church at that time period. But it's also conditioned an awful lot of what we see as traditionalist Catholicism today. The traditionalism of today is really the traditionalism of Trent. It is the Catholic Church of the last 500 years. At the Second Vatican Council, the fathers of the Second Vatican Council came together and said, but now, almost like 500 years later, another council is needed to take us into the modern age. Traditionalist Catholics who hate the Second Vatican Council or think the Second Vatican Council doesn't apply or think it's invalid or whatever would dispute that. Those who believe in the spirit of Vatican II, who have not really read the documents of Vatican II but just sort of have gone in their merry way into more extreme forms of progressivism and radical modernism, have abused what has happened in the Second Vatican Council. It's my own opinion, the Second Vatican Council was actually what the church needed, and the Second Vatican Council, properly understood, was a proper growth from Tridentine Catholicism, preparing us now for the next age in the church. This can be debated, and I don't mind actually the debate. I think it's a healthy debate that goes back and forth, but my own view is that we need to read the documents of the Second Vatican Council in the light of the Council of Trent and in the light of what went on, arguing therefore for what was called a hermeneutic of continuity, that we see in the documents of the Second Vatican Council a proper development, when they're properly understood, of the traditions of Trent and the traditions of the Church before Trent, so that we see this continuity of the Church all the way through. I would wholeheartedly agree, though, that an awful lot of the documents of the Second Vatican Council have not been observed properly, and in the spirit of Vatican II, they've been dismissed completely, as people basically said, oh, now we can do whatever we want, and they have gone on and made changes both in doctrine and in practice and in their morality, which were never condoned by the fathers of the Second Vatican Council and are actually contrary to Catholicism in its true understanding. The other thing which the 17th century reveals to us is this clash between the Jesuits and the Jansenists. In a way, it's very reflective of what's happening in the Church today, because the Jesuits now are seen as progressives, as being radicals, as being modernists. They also have this very optimistic view about human nature. Their constant refrain, the liberals amongst the Jesuits, therefore, their constant refrain of saying, oh, all are welcome. God just loves and forgives everyone. Mercy is the rule. The Church is open to all. And not having strict moral guidelines about some of the moral issues of our day, echoes at the Jesuits back in the 17th century, who were also seen as the being morally relaxed, as being innovators, as being progressives, as being the ones who dismissed the traditions of the past as being useless and trying to reach out to people and make the Church welcoming to all. In the meantime, the Jansenists kind of represent some of the more strict traditionalists in the Church. In fact, when you spend time with some of the more strict traditionalists, you do whiff the kind of moral rigorism and legalism that was the worst aspect of Jansenism, a kind of scrupulosity and legalism in their faith, which was, of course, the shadow side of Jansenism. And so these two kind of extremes within the Church, back and forth, really do reflect on the whole history of the Church, because these two strands, or these two streams of Catholicism, reflect two streams of human nature as well. Those who would always tend to err on the side of the rules and the regulations of religion, on being strict, on being formal, on being legalistic, and having all the I's dotted and all the T's crossed, and being perhaps a bit pessimistic about human nature. This is not just something called Jansenism. This is a trait of human nature. It's a certain personality type which is always present with us. On the other hand, what we can typify as the Jesuit approach in the 17th century is more liberal, more optimistic about human nature, more relaxed about human frailty and human failures, very often finding reasons for people's sin and reason people's wrong decisions and mistakes and making allowances for them. This conflict between, you could call it conservative or liberal or relaxed and strict, whatever you want to call it, Jansenist and Jesuit. Remember, this goes right back to the early days of the Church. Remember the Donatist controversy, when during the persecutions in the early Church, many of the Christians had compromised and their faith, and the ones who were the rigorous were saying they can never be admitted back into the Church. They were Judases. They've forsaken the faith, and they can never be readmitted. And then there were those who said, well, you know, we need to be more relaxed. Christ is forgiving. The Church is forgiving. They made their decisions under duress. You know, they can't. Therefore, they're not responsible. They can be welcomed in by doing some penance and asking forgiveness. They can be welcomed back in. And so, my point is that these two tensions in the Church, between what might be called Jansenist and Jesuit, between legalist and relaxed, between rigorist and easygoing, these two strands within human nature, within the Church, are always there, and they're there in the Church today. What do we do about this? Well, I think we have to actually try to achieve some balance. If you find that you tend to be on the rigorous side, and you're all for rules and regulations, dotting I's and crossing T's, and getting rid of those evil people, and excommunicating the sinners, and asking the bishops who've been problematic to resign and to get out, if you're that kind of a rigorist, well, you need to actually re-examine where you're coming from. If you're, on the other hand, one of the ones who's relaxed, who's saying, well, you know, the sin is just a matter of human frailty. We all do this. You know, God forgives. Let's just be welcoming. Let's be relaxed and understanding about human nature. You know, we can all find God in our own way. And if you tend to be that sort of Catholic, who's what you might be called liberal or on the using the Jansenist Jesuit divide, say, oh, well, the other Jesuits. Well, if you tend to be overly relaxed like that, well, then you also need to re-examine and find a sense of balance. In all of this, I'm always reminded about the parable of the wheat and the tares. Remember the disciples who were going along with Jesus, and they saw the sinners, and they said, we want to get rid of those people. They're not of us. And God, Jesus said, hang on a minute. Look at the wheat and the tares. The wheat and the tares grow together. And in fact, the tares, the weeds, look very much like the wheat. In fact, in the early stages of growth, both of them are green, both of them have small heads of what look like grain, and they're almost indistinguishable. But then by the time of harvest, the wheat has grown in flourished and is golden, and the grains have ripened into grain that can be made into flour, whereas the tares have remained green, and the heads that looked like grain have remained some just small seed heads. And so it's at the harvest time that the sinners and the saints can be sorted out, the sheep and the goats can be sorted out. And in the meantime, Jesus says, just chill out a little bit. This is the nature of the church. There's Jansenists and Jesuits. There's liberals and conservatives. There's strict legalists who are hardliners, and then the ones who are relaxed and easygoing and who are perhaps not strict enough. And so we have to look at this balance in the church and see that this tension is always there. And it's always a painful tension. It's always one that in which we fight with our brothers and sisters, unfortunately, and we become self-righteous on both sides. The rigorists can become very self-righteous, but we forget that the liberals, the relaxed ones, the ones that we're calling the Jesuits in this scenario, also can become very self-righteous and condemnatory and blame the others. And what's needed for the church is to realize, of church unity, is to realize that these tensions are always there, and they're painful and they're difficult to reconcile, but it's something that we have to live with and something which is very Catholic. I hope that helps, and I think it helps me an awful lot, especially as I guess I'm a conservative and I tend to fall sometimes on the rigorous side, and I need to balance that and realize that while there's things that are unhappy in the church, things and leaders that make me unhappy, certainly some priests and some theologians in the church which make me very unhappy, it's something for the sake of Catholic unity and for my own faith that I need to step back and put it in the Lord's hands and say, Lord, it's your church. Do not look on our sins, but on the faith of your church, and to realize that he will not forsake his church, and that we move forward lurching from triumphs to tragedies, but being able to, in the end, know that God is with his church and he will not forsake it. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this series of podcasts. If you would like to follow my blog, I invite you to do so. That's found at dwightlongenecker.com. I try to blog every day if I can on various issues in the church. There's an awful lot of archived material there as well. And I'll remind you that if you would like to support this podcast, and the more that I'm planning to produce as we move into the fall, I've got some plans for some podcast fiction that I plan to be putting out. And if this history podcast has been enjoyable, I hope to perhaps do one on the English Reformation. I apologize if some of the episodes have been sketchy in my research. As I've said at the very beginning, I'm not actually a historian, but I'm researching all of these podcasts to try to share with you this overview of the Catholic Church and the history of the Catholic Church to strengthen your faith and to encourage you to dig deeper, to go and do some of the research yourself if you enjoy history and read further, both online and in books that you can find to promote your learning on the history of the Catholic Church. Thank you for listening. This is Triumphs and Tragedies, and I'm Father Dwight Longenecker.